from 10 till 1.
Mid-mornings with Phil Rowe.
So, looking at Shelford Rugby Club, the new rugby season is set to start in September. Shelford Rugby Club was founded in 1933 and is one of the area's leading clubs. I caught up with Rory Finlayson at an event in the village of Great Shelford. The event was going on over the summer holidays just recently. He's director of youth rugby for the club. Not only that, but he is the assistant coach and the youth fixtures secretary. This is what he had to say.
A little lull in the music at the moment. There's just behind us now one of the lovely jazz bands on a 40-foot trailer, which is getting ready to perform to us. I'm just going to get out of the way of some shuttlecocks as well, the nearby stall, so we don't get treated too much as targets. But in the meantime, on the stall next to them is Rory Finlayson. He's the head of youth at the Shelford Rugby Club. You're looking forward to next season, I guess, Rory, already?
Yes, we've already started pre-season for the seniors, and the youth will start their season when the first Sunday in September comes around.
You're head of youth training for the club?
Well, I head up the youth, so I'm the director of youth rugby for my sins.
So, for your sins. Taking them from what ages? Because, of course, it's boys and girls, isn't it?
It is. We take them from under seven, but that's the catch-all age group, so there'll be 5- and 6-year-olds in the under seven group. So whenever the parents feel that they are ready to do team sport, then we're ready to take them.
You're based down on the Davyfield, just off Cambridge Road in Great Shelford, not far away from where we are this afternoon. You've also got a little activity for everybody. What's going on behind me here? I can see rugby balls in the net.
We've set up a rugby obstacle course to try and show people, or highlight the game really, and try and let them know that the rugby club is an integral part of the village.
And they're going to try and pace their way through those rope ladders, I guess.
That's right. Well, it's quick feet for the ladders, so they normally trip over those. Then it's through the poles, which they normally knock over, then up and collect a rugby ball off of the tackle bag, round the top pole, and then it's a sprint back and a slide on the water slide to the end.
And rain will never stop play when it comes to rugby.
No, the muddier the better, I think.
It's not too muddy just where we are this afternoon, down at the entrance there, where obviously there's a lot of footfall. It's got a little bit muddy around the main marquee. You've also been in the Grand Arena this afternoon.
We have. We've been highlighting both spectrums of the rugby club. So that's the under 8s, which is tag rugby. And then we've had under 16s who have done a demonstration of the top end of the youth. And the seniors will be on later on, we hope.
Started training for the new season yet with the youth teams? Presumably they have their own tournaments as well as the adults?
They do. The youth season doesn't start until September. Some of them will have started pre-season, but that's just the older age group. It's really just the senior sides, which is 17, 18 upwards, who have started.
And there's obviously the summer holidays upon us for the children. Any parents that might be listening to this, how, if they think their child is particularly interested in rugby, the next prodigy maybe, and they want to join the youth side or the youth club or get some training from you, Rory, or from Shelford Rugby Club, where should they apply?
Well, if they want to start playing rugby, they can. If they contact myself, and my details are all on the Shelford website, I'll inform them of which age group they'll fall into, where they need to turn up, what kit they need, and we go from there.
Rory, you look extremely wet, actually, more than most of us. I guess you were pitching out to... It started raining really badly at about 20 to 12, just as everyone was trying to get the gazebo up. Were you out in that?
Unfortunately, I was, but rugby, it's warm, and you know, rain doesn't stop play for rugby, so I was quite pleased to see it, really.
That's the attitude, and it never changes. Rory, thanks very much.
So the club is now a National League side. Pre-season friendlies are being played with this Saturday ahead of the season. They're going with the Shelford First 15 at home to Peterborough Lions at the Davyfield Ground. That's this will touch off at 3 o'clock when the whistle blows for that one. Always get a good crowd down there. That's on Cambridge Road in Great Shelford. I was talking there to Rory Finlayson, who's the Director of Youth Rugby. So some details for him. I will give them out again after the next song. But if you've got some children who perhaps have been a bit stir-crazy over the summer holidays and would like to get down and dirty on a rugby pitch, it's rory.finlayson. It's a little easier than the last email address I gave out. At shandrum.com. .co.uk. So that's rory.finlayson at Shandrum, shandrum.co.uk. Some telephone numbers as well. His mobile, he's allowed us to give out on the radio as well, is 07711 642182. That's 07711 642182. Also, to get hold of Shelford Rugby Club, to get hold of Rory, Cambridge number 834207, if you want to ring his landline, 834207.
From 10 till 1.
Mid-mornings with Mike Pryor.
So we have our guest with us this morning. The Holocaust Memorial Day Trust charity is where our guest is from this morning. The Holocaust Memorial Day is the 27th of January, and in 2015, that day marks the 70th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, the largest Nazi death camp, and also it's the 20th anniversary of the genocide in Srebrenica in Bosnia. And my guest this morning is a lady called Olivia Marks-Waldman. She's the chief executive of the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust, and the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust is the charity established by the government to promote and support the Holocaust Memorial Day, and indeed Her Majesty the Queen is the patron of the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust. So it's a very good morning to Olivia Marks-Waldman. Good morning.
Morning.
How are you this morning?
I'm fine. Thank you very much for having me as a guest on your program. I'm delighted to be with you this today.
Well, you're welcome. And of course, you're in London, which is why we're talking to you on the telephone this morning, Olivia. So maybe what we could do is perhaps start off by asking you, what exactly is the Holocaust Memorial Day?
Holocaust Memorial Day is an international day. It was established in the year 2000 as an international day of remembrance to enable us all, Jews, non-Jews, whatever background we're from, whatever age, to enable everybody to commemorate the past, to look back at the Holocaust and also subsequent genocides and mark them, honour the survivors and do what we can to learn from the past with a view to creating the better future that everybody wants to see.
So do you think there's a danger of desensitization? Because every day we turn the TVs on at the moment, and most of the time it's either talking about the problems that are going on in the Gaza Strip with Israel and so on, or indeed Syria and Iraq with the problems there. So lots and lots of issues that we get reported every day on the TV and on the radio to sort of tell us about what's going on in conflicts around the world. Do you think there's any danger that people see it so much and think of it as something that doesn't relate to them and perhaps desensitize to it?
I think you're right, and that can be a very real danger. And on Holocaust Memorial Day, it enables us to take a bit of time away from our usual lives and not just to flick to another channel or think about something else. And as you say, risk that desensitization, but actually to carve out a bit of time and space and to come together with our neighbours, with our work colleagues, with members of our communities, and actually take that time out to reflect on what really went on, to learn a bit more, and to think about how it is relevant to all of us today. And in those activities, to think about what more we can be doing, either as individuals or together with our own organisations. And there have been some amazing examples of activities that have taken place in Cambridge year on year to mark Holocaust Memorial Day. And in fact, the reason that we're talking about it today is that we, the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust, are about to run a series of workshops around the country so that people can start planning their activities for next year. And there'll be a workshop taking place in Cambridge on the 18th of September.
So I mentioned just before we came on air to talk, I mentioned the fact that last year there was a huge number of events around the country. I was really surprised to find that there was nearly 2,500 different events taking place around the country. And indeed, I was talking last night to one of my neighbours who's an ex-headmaster from a school. And he was telling me about the events that they carried out when he was the headmaster there. And it seems that lots and lots of different organisations all over the country want to get involved with this.
They do. We find that it can be a real day of inspiration for people, and that people can be very passionate about what they're learning and can be very creative in how they put together activities. And yes, we know in Cambridge there have been some amazing things at the university, with the Civic Centre, with the arts programmes, with Cambridge Arts, and just incredible things happening for Holocaust Memorial Day in January this year in 2014. So if any of your listeners want to get involved in what could be going on for January 2015, when, as you said in your introduction, that it will be marking the 70th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, then they'd be very welcome to come to the workshop. But certainly there's some incredibly creative activities in a very wide range of organisations, whether it's arts organisations or libraries or churches and other places of worship, and of all ages too.
How do you think children take to commemorating that? Because again, I spoke recently to some Jewish people who were saying that as far as children are concerned, perhaps it seems such a very distant event in their lives that they can't relate to that. But they recently took them to some relevant places where their grandparents had suffered during the Holocaust and so on, and it brought it back to them in a very, very real sense because it connected with people that they knew.
Mm-hmm. We find that some of our most passionate supporters are young people. We run a youth champion program, and some of the young people who are involved in that are very impressive young people who've learned about the Holocaust and have learned about subsequent genocide, sometimes through school lessons and curriculum lessons, sometimes through examples of, as you've just been suggesting, they've visited relevant places or they've talked to people. And it's really inspired them to think about what they can do to be teaching their peers and encouraging their peers to take a stand. And some of the young people we work with have been really inspirational to us as a staff team, as well as to their own peers. We provide resources to schools and to informal educational groups, youth organisations, because what we find is that sometimes what happens in the curriculum can spark off an interest and a desire to do more. So the resources we provide enable teachers to run lessons and classroom activities and school assemblies around Holocaust Memorial Day. And then our programs, such as our Youth Champion program, enable young people to build on what they've learned and to do other activities with their peers.
Okay, I was looking at you sent me some information through about who in Cambridge took part last year, and I see that some of the organisers included the City Council, the University Jewish Society, Long Road Sixth Form College, the Arts Picture House, Mumford Theatre, and also the Wolf Institute. So a very, very diverse set of organisations taking part. How can people actually get involved? What kind of activities do you think people can organise?
There's the list is as limitless as the imagination, really. Some of the most successful activities we've seen in Cambridge have been with Key Stage Arts and some of the very theatrical interpretations of theatrical works that can be developed and enable a very wide audience come together and learn from the performance and use that as an opportunity for reflection. We've seen student groups organise lecture events and also work together to do theatrical events and have discussions after that. And the council in Cambridge has been tremendous in working with a range of partners to develop a whole series of events involving youth choirs and Jewish choirs coming together, supporting the Jewish community in Cambridge to reach out to mainstream neighbours and communities. So there have been fantastic things happening in Cambridge. And I really would encourage any of your listeners who want to be involved either to log on to our website, hmd.org.uk, for resources and ideas, or come along to the workshop on the 18th of September.
So they don't really need to give you any information about what they want to do in advance of the workshop, do they? Or they just simply turn up and then they'll talk to someone?
They turn up and the workshop will be run by us, by the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust, and we will assist people in developing their activities. So the workshop will talk through different ideas. It will talk about the theme for 2015. Part of our role is to identify a different theme each year, which enables people to approach Holocaust Memorial Day in a new way each year. And we'll be able to use that as an opportunity to talk through the different ideas that people have and to show them the resources that we've produced that will help them. So some of those resources are films and videos. Some of them are written text resources, such as the school's resources, but other resources based on the life stories of people who've been affected by the Holocaust and by subsequent genocide too.
And that's probably worthwhile mentioning, of course. We tend to think, when you mention the Holocaust, of course, of the Second World War. But in terms of genocide, there's been a significant number of events as far as genocide around the world since then, really. I mean, just thinking, you know, as we speak at the moment, what's going on in Iraq, in Syria, I guess could be considered to be a genocide-type act as well.
Genocide is a very particular crime, which is why Holocaust Memorial Day is very specific about marking the genocides in Cambodia, Rwanda, Bosnia and Darfur. These are all crimes of where genocide has taken place or where perpetrators have been indicted for the crime of genocide. And as you said in your introduction, in 2015 we'll be marking the 20th anniversary of the genocide in Srebrenica in Bosnia. And of course, genocide doesn't come out of nowhere. There are stages that lead to it. And problems of discrimination and prejudice and hate crime haven't gone away. So Holocaust Memorial Day really is an opportunity for people to learn about what has happened in the past and to reflect on their own behavior. And in fact, the theme that we've chosen for 2015 is the theme of keeping the memory alive. And we're hoping that people who participate in Holocaust Memorial Day activities next year and who organise them will be looking at ways that we can all keep the memory alive of what happened in the past and our own responsibilities for sharing those memories with others.
Okay, so there are two events, as I said there. You've got your workshop on the 18th of September?
That's right.
Yeah, and then
in the afternoon.
In the afternoon, and then the actual Memorial Day is 27th of January next year.
That's
so
right.
You mentioned the website again. So if people would like to organise something or get involved, do you want to give us some details there again?
Yes, thank you. The workshop is on the 18th of September in Cambridge. If anybody would like to attend, please log on through our website, hmd.org.uk. And the workshop will give you resources and advice on developing your own activity for marking Holocaust Memorial Day. Nearer the day itself in January, there will be indications on our website of all the activities happening across the UK. And if people want to attend an event as a participant, not as an organiser, then they'd be very welcome to log on to the website then or get in touch with us to find out what activities will be happening near them. So there's the opportunities to be involved to organise an activity and also to attend as a participant. And we'd be delighted to hear about any of your plans or interests in Holocaust Memorial Day. And of course, if any of your listeners are young people or work with young people, then you can also find out more about our Youth Champion programme through the website too.
Well, that's great. Well, thanks very much for giving us your time this morning, Olivia, to talk about that. And let's hope that on the 18th of September, you get a lot of response to the request that you've made this morning to get involved.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks very much for coming and speaking to us.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye. So that's Olivia Marks-Waldman from the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust charity. And as she said, if you want more information, the website address is hmd.org.uk. And indeed, they have a Twitter account as well, which is at hmd_UK, if you'd like more information.
From 10 till 1,
mid-mornings with Phil Rowe.
Cambridge 105.
So it's not often I meet a gardener in the studio. We haven't really got a gardening spot on the station. I had to put him on the green microphone, of course. Good morning to you, Tony.
Yeah, good morning, Phil.
Thanks for spending some time with us. A head gardener, too. So I doff my hat to you, sir.
Oh, it's not that prestigious.
Newnham College. Well, you have a team of gentlemen and maybe ladies working with you.
I've got four members of staff, but at the moment, no female gardeners.
No female gardeners. No. Of course, they are out there as well doing the job.
Yeah.
I'm a resident of Cambridge. I'm a townie rather than a gown, but I do enjoy the university backs and seeing, and I can appreciate the work that you all do. Newnham's obviously not on the backs. It's tucked a little bit from the centre of the main cluster of the colleges that make up the University of Cambridge, but still a fine building.
Yeah, we're just behind or just off Sidgwick Avenue, so opposite the university's faculty buildings.
Come across Silver Street, across the Queen's Road Junction, head up Sedgwick.
Straight up. First one you'll come to is Ridley Hall.
That's it.
And then we're immediately next to Ridley Hall. And behind the buildings and car parks, we've got between 18 and 20 acres of gardens.
Are you ever open on during the summer to the public?
We do open, but it's pretty much open all the time if you go in via the Newnham Walk gates. It's open all the while.
Oh, well, public can wander around. We can come on site and look
come
at the college.
Come on site and have a look,
and admire your work as a team.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, the reason we got you in today is you actually came through on a little press release earlier in the week. Very well written one, actually. You're going to be doing something that I know you would never have done before. Another thing I need to ask you first, got a slight moustache going on there. Are you going to shave for the day?
I'll probably trim it back so it's there, but I've had the moustache now for about 40 years, so it's probably going to stay. But I'll trim it back so that it's there.
You're going green for the day, Tony. We should explain exactly what you're up to.
I am.
You're going to go very green-fingered and more besides.
And more besides, yes. I was issued a kind of challenge. It was a bit of a throwaway challenge, and you get these occasions where afterwards you wished you'd sort of put the brain in gear slightly before the mouth went into motion. But, you know, there we are, we've done it. And the challenge was, it was suggested rather than challenged, that maybe it would be a good idea if I went to work wearing green lipstick, green nail polish and maybe green shoes. And it was kind of, well, yeah, there's not a lot to that. And then you walk away thinking, oh, God.
Well done.
But in all honesty, Phil, since we've got the campaign rolling and the money started coming in and is coming in sort of really well, it becomes more wanting to do it, let's put it that way.
I can see that.
You know, you get more and more into the thing as it goes on.
I guess you build your courage through the fact that you're building a bit of confidence because the money's coming in.
Yeah, yeah.
You've always wanted to target at least £500, and we know.
Yeah.
I'm trying to hit your website this morning. It's probably me rather than you, but I know you're up at least. We think around £600.
£600. I think it's in reality, if you take the fact that all the donations are gift aided, which is another 25% of what you give, I think we're up into the 800 now.
Most people can gift aid. It depends, of course, on your tax status.
If you
pay PAYE, and if you pay more PAYE to the government, sadly, than the amount you gift aid every year, then you're within the tax rules. So most people can do that. That's really good. So go on you. Firstly, obviously, this website will remain open, and we're talking about, of course, the Just Giving website, even after the event.
So it will stay open, I assume, for a week or 10 days after the event, yeah.
And when are you going to pluck up courage to do this then, Tony?
Monday the 8th of September.
Right.
Which is a week this coming Monday.
Gives you all weekend to think about it.
Yeah. No, there was a, I was asked the other day if I would do it on the 1st because that starts off the Hort Aid Charity Week for Perennial. And but unfortunately, I have to go to quite a big function at Hatfield House on Monday, and it would be a bit inappropriate to turn up wearing green lipstick and a green wig.
Which in itself has marvellous grounds and marvellous gardens as well, which I've been long to see myself.
Yeah.
So we also Before we actually ask you a bit about perennial, how are you going to get to work that day? Because you're going to get dressed up home before you go to college.
I probably won't put the wig on at home. I should probably go by car. I usually go into work by car anyway.
Oh, okay.
When you've got a physique like mine, bikes and that are not great. And there's no direct public transport route as such, so...
You're going to look like the Jolly
walking
Green.
Through the town changing buses, isn't it?
You don't mind me saying, I know, that you're quite a rotund gentleman, so you're probably going to end up like the Jolly Green Giant that day, would you say?
Probably, yes, yes.
Of a fairly powerful and imposing stature. So I don't know whether you'd really want to get on the bus. So it's going to be green shoes.
Green shoes.
Are you going to manage to find some that will fit you?
What I should probably do is... get a pair of old work shoes and I shall paint those green over the weekend and wear those.
Yeah.
I'm not sure my feet would actually go into a pair of green shoes and I'm not sure where I would actually get hold of a pair of man's shoes that were green. But
And your wife's going to do the wardrobe for you before you go out in the morning.
The wife will probably do the wardrobe before I go in the morning, yeah.
So and on that day?
She'll have to put the lipstick on. The last time I wore lipstick was in a school play about 50 years ago, so...
You confess.
a secret confession, yes.
So this will be for Monday the 8th of September. We know that it's now going to go ahead, you see, because you've
already gone through
your threshold. So, yeah, no, absolutely. You're going to be wearing it all day.
Yep.
There's going to be a lot of ribbing, isn't there, from all your colleagues at Unum College.
Absolutely. It's already started, so on the day I'll just... I probably wear greenie and blockers as well, earplugs, just
Do you go into the refectory and have your lunch
in
the hall?
I do at lunchtimes, yeah.
So again, more ribbing from the kitchen staff?
Lots of ribbing from the kitchen staff. The maintenance guys will be giving me absolute hell. The porters at the Porter's Lodge and house porters and my guys, I dread to think what they'll do.
It's an all-ladies college, this one, so that's quite interesting, isn't it? And the principal knows what you're up to, presumably?
She does, yes, yes. But it's all ladies, but... kind of fortunately, the students won't be back when I'm doing it. So the students are still down.
Are some of them donating towards this as well, if they're aware of what you're doing? Because some will be there over the summer months, presumably doing extra studies.
Extra studies. We've had a promise from some graduates.
Very good.
Which is, we count as students, but in the main, they're the next generation on. And several of our senior members, fellows, have made some generous donations as well. So... And there's two or three of those I'm expecting an immense amount of ribbing from as well.
An immense amount of money to go with it, I hope. Make it worthwhile.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So we ought to talk about Perennial, the Gardeners Royal Benevolent Society, and what it does then, Tony. It's the UK's only charity dedicated to helping horticulturalists in need. I suppose, sadly, I mean, gardening, it's a wonderful, relaxing job. I admire you in the summer doing it. It can be harsh in the winter, of course, because you have to work sometimes in all weathers, even on frosty days, even when the ground's frozen over and you're still trying to pick something out of the soil that shouldn't be there, or even plant something, because maybe that's the weird time of year that nature says you put it in the ground.
Definitely not when it's frozen.
Not when it's frozen, I'd imagine, after having said what I had just said there. So, you know, it's probably not an industry that pays so well.
No, in the main, it's a low-paid industry, which is partly why Perennial was originally formed. And in its early days, it provided housing for gardeners and horticulturalists who reached the ends of their working lives and lived in tired accommodation. Got nowhere to live, obviously never earned enough money to be able to put anything to one side to secure their housing future, if you like. And then from there it's expanded and they provide, if a gardener either working or retired sort of gets hard times through financial problems, medical problems, social problems, they offer all kinds of support. And they've helped several of my friends have been helped in ways that you can't imagine, really. With one friend had a massive stroke while he was away from home. They sorted out all his problems where he was. When he eventually got home, they sorted his home out. They built him a stair lift, walk-in shower, ramps up to his house, and as he's subsequently had more strokes, but they now help him out in in a care home.
Yes.
And, you know, they sorted his finances out. He was not daft with his money, this guy, but they sorted all his money out, rejiggled his pensions, rejiggled this, and he finished up being about £100 a month better off.
Yeah.
And it's all at no cost. It's all totally what we fund. And this year they're 175 years old. So we've got a Hortaid week.
Hortaid
2 weeks.
Week, yes.
Which starts on Monday. And it's 2 weeks. There's other people up and down the country doing various things, but I honestly couldn't tell you quite what's going on.
Across Cambridge, there are actually 100 of you that work in each of the different colleges.
Probably around there, yeah.
Around that
yeah,
number.
Yeah, around that number.
And I guess you're fairly close-knit. I guess you might sort of transfer between colleges if there's promotions and that kind of thing. So I guess most of you know each other, would that be true to say?
We pretty much know each other. All the head gardeners know each other. And as you say, you get comings and goings. But in reality, the transfer of gardeners from one college to another is not that great. You don't get many people going from one college to another.
May I ask how long you've been in your current employ then, Tony? Quite a long time, I'd imagine.
It's 25 years, coming up for 26.
So all for Newnham College?
All at Newnham College. Yeah. Prior to that, I was at Trinity College for a little while, for a couple of years. And then before that, I'd been self-employed and subcontracting with cutting grass and doing things on anything from university sites to like Waterbeach Airfield, big landscaping contracts and that type of thing. But it was a rat race, so I just got out of it. I wanted time to myself.
And not only that, we'll just mention very quickly that not only are you head gardener at Newnham College, but you also are the chairman of the Professional Gardeners Guild offices as well, which is another organisation. So you're a busy man.
Oh, yeah. I keeps me well occupied.
So if you'd like to top up the very good course that Tony has here, we know that what you do is a very stress-free job.
It's fairly stress-free. Yeah. It has its moments. But in the main, yeah, it's stress-free.
But there are times of needs for gardeners, and this is exactly what the charity is all about. If you do want to give a little bit of money, so far, actually, when I did look earlier in this week, I did have a figure of £565, Tony, but I know it's gone up on that, including on the Just Giving website. So you can go to that website. It's justgiving.com. It's /green lipstick, all one word. Yeah. Or if you just put in a little search in the box on their website, Green Lipstick.
Should take you straight there.
Should take you straight there. Tony, you're going to be taking yourself to work in a very unique style on the 8th of September.
We'll make sure you get a photograph, Phil, which will be absolutely useless for the radio, I appreciate.
But well, we'll see what we can do. Put it on our Facebook. Send it to our Facebook page, Cambridge 105. Sure. We'd love to see that, actually.
Yeah.
Or tweet it through to us at Cambridge 105. Tony, I wish you good luck. I suppose you do need luck with it.
Yeah.
In a way. You're going to wear it all the way home again that day?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. By that time of the day, I won't really give a monkey sort of thing. I should have got so used to it. I should got used to the ribbing and
any pride you ever had was, you know, is beyond.
Yep.
Beyond care, beyond regard.
And the mayhem it will cause when I sit at the traffic lights, people looking in your car window thinking, what on earth is that idiot doing.
Thanks very much for coming in today. Anyway, that's Tony Arnold, who's raising money for a Perennial, the horticultural charity supporting gardening workers here in the UK. Thanks very much for that.
Okay.
Saturday Breakfast with Ian Dayborn. Cambridge
105. 24 minutes past 9 o'clock. No, 23 minutes. Let's get it right. I've got another colleague in here. I've got to do the links properly, haven't I, in the time checks, John?
Very good morning, Ian. How are you?
Yeah, I'm not too bad. Thank you. Not too bad.
Good.
So you're normally here on a Sunday for a 60s scene.
Yes, between 11 and 1.
And before you go, we'll definitely let you plug what's going to happen tomorrow morning.
Thank you very much.
But as I was saying earlier, you're not here to talk about the 60s this morning. You're here to talk about something that, I don't know if it's a taboo subject or not, but it's something I think it's good to talk about and something that you were very keen to come in and have a chat about. And where do we start this story? I suppose the best way to start is to say that you've got or been suffering with cancer, haven't you? And you're being treated for that at the moment. So tell us about what form you've got.
Yeah, I have a thing called non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and it was diagnosed back in April. And at the time, I was a very unsure of my future, obviously, especially here on the radio station. But, I mean, I've been having chemo treatment ever since the diagnosis, and things have gone really quite well.
And you're being looked after at Addenbrooke's, I think, aren't you?
Oh, Addenbrooke's Oncology Department. Yes, I can't praise them enough, actually. They are so good down there, so patient, so friendly, and so helpful. And they do make you feel very much at ease. I mean, although you're going through quite a terrible time with chemo, and it can be quite daunting, they really put you at ease, and I can't praise them enough. They're so good down there, they really are.
So, John, tell us, we've all heard of chemotherapy, obviously, and I'm sure lots of us just kind of block the whole thing out. What happens? Tell us what to expect. If something, if we had to go, or a member of our family has experienced something like this, what does it actually involve?
Well, there are various types of chemotherapy, obviously, but my particular type of chemotherapy was called R-CHOP. Now, R-CHOP has nothing to do with cutting or chopping. It purely relates to the initials of the chemicals they use for the actual chemo infusion into your body.
Yes.
And what basically happens, you're sat down on a chair or a bed, and a cannula is put in the back of your hand, and they infuse you. It takes about 3 or 4 hours for the infusion. They do the R part first, which is the most important part, because that actually fights off the bad white cells in the body and replenishes them. And then the CHOP are the main chemo chemicals that go into the body afterwards. But they have to be done very, very slowly, obviously, because the body has to quickly acclimatise to them. And it's not painful. It's just a bit boring, to be quite honest. You have to sit there and just wait for the treatment to be infused into your body. And once it's all over, you can go home. But the first 4 treatments I had to have a thing called a lumbar puncture as well.
Yeah.
Now, lumbar punctures, to most people, conjure up quite dreadful things. But I found the lumbar puncture part of it very, very painless, actually. The doctor assured me that I probably wouldn't feel very much. She laid me on my side. She said, I'll put in a local anaesthetic, which obviously you feel a local anaesthetic going, not very much, just a pinprick. And then she said to me, do you feel any pain? So I said, no. And she said, well, I finished. I didn't feel a thing. And they actually take out 10 drops sampled from the spinal fluid and inject more chemo into the spine. It's to protect the brain, I think, you know. But that was totally painless. So if anybody has to go for a lumbar puncture, don't worry. You'll find that totally painless and very, very easy to do.
And in terms of preparation for the treatment, was everything explained clearly to you before you started?
Very much so. The doctors and the nurses were brilliant. Every time they did any sort of procedure, they sat me down and told me exactly what I was going to do and to make sure that I was clear in my mind what was going to happen. They were very, very good.
And they refer to chemo as cycles, don't they? And a cycle is a, well, it depends, I suppose, on your individual situation. But how many lots of this are you going to have? How many have you had so far?
Right, I have to have 8. I've had 6 so far. I've got 2 more to go. The doctor assures me that I should be having a scan before the last one to find out how things are going. I had a scan after the second session, and that proved that the lymphoma had reduced significantly in my body, and the doctor was extremely pleased at that time, and he said that, well, we'll do the whole session of 8. And then hopefully things will be in total remission by that time. We hope, anyway. Touch wood. Fingers crossed.
Absolutely. See how things go along. So in terms of this particular form of cancer, there is non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and Hodgkin's lymphoma, isn't there? There are two different types. Yeah. Are they different or similar?
Yeah, Hodgkin's is more difficult to actually treat. Non-Hodgkin's is the most treatable, I'm glad to say.
Yes.
And that they do tend to find that they can treat that quite easily. Well, not easily, but easily enough anyway, you know. So, I mean, you don't know, obviously, what type you've got until you've been diagnosed. I mean, non-Hodgkin's is the most common type of cancer these days, you know.
And what about side effects? Because obviously that's the other thing we all think of when people mention the word chemotherapy to us. We think about losing our hair and that sort of thing. What have been the side effects for you?
Well, this was my big worry, obviously. When the doctor said to me, you're going to have to undergo now 6 months of chemotherapy, your mind races, you know. I mean, you just think, well, what am I going to go through for the next 6 months? But actually, I've been very fortunate. Side effects for me have been very minimal. My hair has thinned quite considerably, and I've had sometimes a strange taste in the mouth where some of the things that I normally enjoy didn't taste quite the same, but I was told to expect that. And I've also suffered a few times with mouth ulcers. But that's it, really. I mean, most of the time I felt extremely well. Obviously, lymphoma prior to my treatment was dragging me down quite badly, but since I've been having the treatment, I felt extremely well. I've been able to continue most times with everyday life. I've been able to go to work, do my radio show, of course.
Of course,
the most important part. But so I've been very fortunate, I feel.
Yeah, well, that's great. Well, you mentioned there about how you were feeling before you had the diagnosis. So if you've just tuned in, my guest is John Gannon, presents the 60 Scene, as we were saying. And, John's been fighting cancer. He's had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. He's coming towards the end of chemotherapy. He's feeling good. But let's spool back, John. Here we sit, August 2014. When, if you could put your finger on it, do you think... Now, looking back, things started to feel not quite right for your health, for you health-wise, would you say?
It was just prior to Christmas. I actually caught shingles. Now, shingles, as you probably know, is very painful anyway, but I had shingles in the back of my leg and on the base of my foot, would you believe? So walking was extremely painful. But anyway, the shingles cleared up. Well, by Christmas time, I was feeling that the shingles were going anyway, and I was hoping that they were going to be okay because I wanted to see my grandchildren over Christmas. So, but no, I was okay by Christmas. But then after Christmas, once Christmas was over and the new year began, I didn't feel quite right, and I just put it down to the shingles, thinking that the shingles was making me feel a bit under the weather. But as time passed, I got to sort of February, March, and I still didn't feel quite right. Now, I knew there was something wrong. I felt very tired, very lethargic. The worst thing was I lost my appetite, and most of the things that I enjoyed eating, I didn't enjoy anymore. And in fact, sometimes I just didn't want to eat, which my wife felt was most unusual for me, because I do have a healthy appetite normally. Anyway, so I used to go to work, and some days at work I'd cheerfully come home because I just felt so bad. You know, I feel I should go home, but I stuck it out thinking that they will get better. But I knew there was something not quite right, so I thought I'd go and have to go and see the doctor and see what was happening, because I used to wake most mornings with terrible pains in my abdomen, my stomach, and when I got up the pains would go. Excuse me, frog in the throat this morning. Yeah, and so the pains used to go away, so I didn't think too much about them during the course of the day, but I still didn't feel right, you know. So I went to see my doctor eventually, and I said to her, look, I've been suffering with these pains in my stomach, I said, and obviously I don't feel very good. So she examined me, and she said she found a lump in my groin. And she says, oh, I think you have a hernia, and that's probably what's causing your pain. So I said, oh, that's good. At least you found something to cause the pain. So she said, I'll arrange for the hernia clinic to check you out and see what the problem is. So I thought, fine. She said, in the meantime, I'll take a blood test and see what else, you know, is anything else wrong. So I went back to see her a short while later, and she said, the blood test was not quite conclusive. She said, one of the two things I'm not quite happy about, one of the blood count's not very good on one of them. And she said, how are you feeling? So I said, well, I'm still much the same. But I said, since I've seen you last, I now have a lump on my throat. Right. I had a swelling. I had a gland come up on my throat. And she says, oh, I'm not very happy about the gland. She said, let me have a look. So she examined me again. And she says, believe it or not, you have a lump on your throat, a lump under your arm, and the lump on your groin is definitely not a hernia, it's a swollen gland. Mm. We'll have to get you to hospital as quickly as possible. So she arranged for me to go to hospital. I had a scan and then a biopsy, and the biopsy proved to be non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which came as quite of a shock, as you can imagine. But in a way, it gave a slight relief to me, because at least I knew now what was causing my problem, why I wasn't feeling well, you know. Yes. Because obviously I felt under the weather for quite some time. And at least now they diagnosed the problem. That was the thing. I mean, although it was very daunting when he said, oh, it could be 6 months of chemotherapy, I thought, well, at least they're going to cure the problem. That's the thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And when they started to find these lumps, John, I mean, were you in the back of your mind starting, because we all tend to fear the worst, don't we? Were you starting to feel that way, or what, were you genuinely surprised when you got
the diagnosis? I was just genuinely surprised, because, I mean, when the gland came up on my neck, I noticed that I was shaving one morning, and I just thought, oh, I have a swollen gland. It's probably just due to the fact that I'm not feeling well, you know, just to pop the gland come up. I didn't for 1 minute think that it would be anything serious as it was, you know. It was only when the doctor said, oh, you have a lump under your arm as well, which I hadn't been aware of, but she found it, and she said the lump on your groin, of course, she said, is not a hernia now. She said it's definitely a swollen gland as well, and she was very worried about that, because that was in a very bad place where it could cut off the blood supply to my leg and could cause DVT.
All sorts of complications, yeah. So they got you straight into treatment, which is where we started chatting.
Yes.
And how did your family react? Because obviously you've got children, you've got grandchildren.
Well, they were all very shocked. My wife particularly, she's been my tower of strength. She really has. I mean, but she was very, very shocked. I mean, we didn't for 1 minute think it was going to be anything as serious as that. And we thought, well, we've got to face this and just get through it. You know what I mean? Obviously, we'll just have to go ahead. And well, the doctor said to me, believe it or not, he said, a couple of 2 or 3 months at the most, if you come to see me, I wouldn't have been able to help you.
Really?
Yeah, so I was very lucky to get there when I did. So I would say to anybody, if you don't feel well, please do see your doctor, because it could be something as serious as you, as this, you know, and do get it checked out if you don't feel well, because I definitely knew there was something wrong anyway.
It's an interesting story, and it's good that you're so happy to come in and speak about things. And John, I mean, we could go on, but we're nearly out of time. We're nearly being interrupted by the travel. You know how it is here. But just to mention again, well, a few people probably you want to mention your wife's name. Remind us what you're.
My wife is Lily. Now Lily has been my tower of strength. Without her, I'd never have got through this. I can quite assure you. She thinks she hasn't been any help, but believe me, without her, I would never have got this far. I really wouldn't. And of course, the oncology department at Adam Brooks, they have been absolutely brilliant. Every time I've been for the treatment, they have been marvellous. They really have. Patient, understanding, and so helpful and friendly.
All about the city.
Cambridge 105.